And there you go. There you go. The jam at the tube station after midnight. And I should be joined on the line by Sean. Good morning to you, Sean.
Good morning, Debbie. How are you?
Not too bad. So Sean Curran is talking to us today about how your life has changed over the years as well. I won't give out any more. So you just tell us a little bit about how you changed your life and how it all started.
Yeah, well, just want to say good morning. Good morning, Debbie. And good morning to all your listeners. I was just, I'll tell you, well, I'll just start with this morning for you. Can I do that?
You can do that.
Okay. So this morning, Colin was on to me last night, Colin Fogarty, about his charity thing for the Bridges of Hope. And I was teasing him and I said to him, you get off to work there. There's people with coffee in their hand waiting to hear you doing your radio chats. And I didn't realise he was actually supposed to be on the radio this morning and he couldn't make it. Of course, he followed back and said to me, could you go on the radio and do an interview yourself? So that's how I find myself this morning. In one respect, talking to you.
Well, we've listened and we've heard, John's story, John Edwards' story, and the book he's written, his autobiography. I don't know whether you've read it, but absolutely brilliant. A lovely man, and how he turned his life completely around. So, Sean, you're on this morning talking really about, I suppose, how you've turned your life around as well.
Okay, so my story is, I spent a lot of my life in prison, you know. I started out just a young kid in Finglas, you know, in the 70s, and I sort of had a difficult relationship at home, difficult relationship with my dad, and just things, how things spoiled from a young kid just trying to get to school and just, you know, do the things of family, etc. And I was actually abused on the way to school, very, very, probably one of my very early days in school, 3 or 4, just somebody hiding in the bushes and just was attacked, you know, and just, I don't know if those things have a part to play, but they definitely burden you as a person, and I think they, for me, added to the stuff that I was carrying, that when I encountered drugs and stuff like that kind of, it just it pushed me into that place, you know, where I was going in a downward spiral. So, let me say, I don't know, ask the question, please, Debbie.
I'm just, you're saying it started off, you think, as a, you know, as a child. And I suppose, you know, that is the foundation of our lives, really. And if we're shown, you know, the right path to go on. And I know, like John himself said, he grew up in Clontarf. He came from a, you know, a really stable family. And is it the crowd, do you think it's the people you kind of get in with that lead you, or is it in yourself?
It is and it isn't. I'll put it this way to you. What happened was, for me, I had a lot of turmoil at home, and it was, doors were open, it drove me onto the street, and when I went onto the street and just increasingly I wanted to escape and just escape from family life, and I wanted to escape the authority of the home. I had a difficult relationship with my dad, as I said, and I felt, you know, I just didn't want his authority upon me. I felt that it wasn't the right authority, a correct authority. And so I began to hang out with just kids very similar who were running from the homes and their actual home life. And these just began to steal bicycles and just very simple things, and drink, and then get in stolen cars and steal motorbikes, just as really young kids, you know, I'm talking about 12, 13 years of age. And it just, the spiral, the whirlwind, just the power of the whirlwind just increased and increasingly forced me into a darker lifestyle, you know.
And were you, as a child, you said 12 to start, were you kind of allowed to do what you wanted? Was there somebody supervising you to where you were? What are you doing?
No.
So you were kind
of. My dad was very strict, authoritarian. He was a night worker. And I had a great school. I did really, really well in school. I loved school life, but just the chaos of, a little bit of chaos at home and turmoil and sort of stuff that went on in the 70s, you know, domestic sort of violence and stuff like that. It was a difficult place, a difficult environment for a kid, and I saw escape and saw solace. That's the way it was, you know, and there was always a check on what I was up to. and I helped, you know.
You know, you say, oh, it's the parents. It actually, you know, 9 out of 10 times it's not the parents' fault and they do their best.
No,
and
no,
it just happens.
No.
Either you go in with the wrong crowd or it's, I don't know. But so this happened, like you're saying, kind of petty theft and bikes and that. And when, like, was the worst part? When did it get really bad?
Oh, well, listen, you're talking about, that drove me into what you see in Dublin now, drug taking, drug addiction, alcoholism, drinking. So my life was actually, I actually lived my life in that, you know, and I spent probably 20 or 30 years, over 30 years in crime and violence in prison. I spent over 10 years of my life actually in prison.
Mm-hmm.
And I was involved in all the gang stuff, drug dealing, armed robbery, and committing violence, you know, for money, and just the worst dredges of things that I'm ashamed to say now, but at the time were normal living for me, you know.
Yeah.
That was normal. Everyone around me, that was the culture of people that I chose to be with, you know. And for me, what happened was I tried to live a life in tandem, you know. I tried to have a family life and partner and raise children, you know, as I went, but it just was, I just brought chaos and sowed chaos into everyone's life around me, you know.
Yeah.
So what happened for me was my kid brother died in prison.
Oh,
and the day he died in prison, my first grandson was actually born. And that was, you know, I did have the desire, like most people trapped in addiction, to escape, to come out, you know. I did have that desire, but I just couldn't. I tried so many times and I couldn't find the way out, the door out, you know. And it took this, my first grandson was born, and just something happened in my heart, you know. I just felt I have to do something. It just really, I came to that place, you know.
Yeah, they say that you need that something to click in yourself, that, right, I have to do this.
Yeah.
Because you could be getting help from a lot of people or a lot of people, or will do this, but it has to be yourself, doesn't it? Something has to kick in, so I want
to
do this for me.
You have to have ears.
Yeah.
You have to have ears to hear. The ears inside you, the ears have to be... People spoke to me before, you know, but it just didn't resonate.
Yeah.
And just that particular time, you know, first grand... Now, my daughter named my grandson the same name as my brother, and it just profoundly impacted me, you know. And that was the beginning for me, you know. I was actually attending, believe it or not, a probation officer, Aidan Trant. He's still in probation services. And I went in and I broke down crying in his office. He was asking me, could I do community service? And I broke down crying to him, chronic heroin addict. I can't help myself. I can hardly get to this office.
Yeah.
I need help. And he lifted the phone to inquire local drug services. I told them that I was on their list to go to rehab, and he lifted the phone to inquire, and somehow that must have just lent weight. I found myself on the 6th of the 6th, 06, 666,
oh, the 6th.
Going into rehab, and that was where everything changed for me.
So that was your turning point?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, it sounds, and Colm is saying as well, it sounds like you got a turning point and you have this life now that you're happy in. But it must have been very, very hard after all, you know, all them years been on heroin.
Absolutely.
And that life to change. I mean, how did you replace that life? Like, what did you do? What did you replace it with?
Okay, so for me, again, you're speaking a very, very profound truth when you say that. You know, if you're going to come into recovery, you know, it'd be great if you could go away and go train, and like they train for a boxing match or something, you know, those things, and eat properly. But you don't. What happens is you're usually at the end of yourself, and you're so weak and fragile as a person, mentally and emotionally and psychologically. And then the drugs, which were your support, are taken from you, and you want them taken. And when they go, suddenly all the memories of your life come back. And every harm you ever did and every horrible situation you were ever in comes back to you, and every emotion that you didn't feel when someone belonged to you, close to you, died because you were frozen in a cocoon of drugs, swamps you. And it's a very, very hard one time. But with the help, you can come through, you know. For myself, I went in on the 6th of the 6th, and I said to you earlier that I had this moment of clarity in rehab, and I just really had it for myself. My daughter came to see me in rehab, and I suddenly saw for the first time how I damaged her. Yeah. I'd never seen the harm before. I looked at her, and I read her body language in an instant. I realised that her body language spoke to me and said, "Yeah, you're going to get clean, are you?" You know, from across the room.
Mm,
you've seen this all before without saying a word. And I was so impacted. And I went back to the room when she left, and something I'd never done before. I spoke to the sky and said, "If there's a God, I need help," because I suddenly realised the damage I've done and how serious this is and how I've walked myself into a place and promised that I'm going to try to do something.
I suppose at that stage, Sean, it was either, you know, you go one way or the other. It's either, you know, this is going to kill you or this was going to make you, really. You had to do something probably at this stage in your life.
You know when people say, "I've seen the light"?
Mm.
You ever heard some? Well, that's kind of what happened to me. I suddenly had a just deep moment of clarity and revelation, and just some sort of power just touched me inside. And the power of God is what I really feel. You know, most people in recovery will talk about things like this, a moment of transformation, a moment of turning point, a moment when they suddenly realise that there's something greater than them, and there is, you know, assistance. And that's what happened to me, and that was the beginning of my journey back.
Okay, so I know we haven't got much time now, but so that was the day your divine intervention came and you said that was it, you know, you found God. And how has life been since?
Absolutely amazing. From that moment, all I wanted to do was tell people that there is help. I wanted to just intervene in people in drug addictions' lives and just talk about a solution. There is a way out. There is hope. And it's just been such a super wonderful journey. I got clean and sober at 40, and the years since then have been the most fulfilling time of my life. I thought my life was over at 40, and lo and behold, it's not. We've just been, I got married in 2014 after about 8 years of doing that, and that's another area of my life I thought was over. I wasn't really interested in anything like that.
Yeah.
I met this wonderful woman, and the very first day I met her, I asked her to marry me. That's how.
Wow. How much in love fell in love with her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, what I would like to say to you is, my life has been absolutely transformed. I actually, believe it or not, I'm actually a minister today.
Are you really?
One of the oldest and most conservative Pentecostal churches, Elam ministry in Ireland. I actually did a wedding on Sunday. Married some people who we saw come, for a couple who we saw come from really a place of brokenness, and saw their lives transformed, and had the great honour of ministering the service. It was just wonderful, absolutely wonderful.
That's,
you know,
absolutely great.
So, could I just say to you, Debbie, that, you know, I was just looking at the name of the radio station, Near FM, and I just, you know, I first felt just to say this morning that I was teasing Colm about, you know, there's people with coffee in their hand waiting for a chat. And I just want to say that, you know, that for me, those moments of, you know, aloneness, just looking for an answer, looking for help, and that actually is, you know, there is a power that is closer and nearer than even your own heart. And there is a solution and help.
There is, yeah. But as you said, Sean, you need to want it for yourself as well. And, like, how many years now are you clean and of everything?
Well, about 11, coming up on 12 years. And 12 years in the 6th of June.
Congratulations.
So it's just been an absolutely wonderful journey. But you do need support. You do need fellowship around you. You need to tap into programs and resources that are out there. You cannot do it on your own. That's the real message, you know.
Well, can I just ask you something, Sean? If people are looking for help, do you not have to be clean before they give you help in the centres here?
There is quite a lot of things like that, you know.
Yep.
Quite a lot of rehabs where they ask you to be clean, and there's a lot of legal structures and you know, regulations, and a lot of it's for safety. I really have to say that, but it's very difficult. You know, it's a difficult journey to get. You'd have to rehab.
But you'd have to have help to get clean to before you can get the help off somebody. It just doesn't seem logic. Like, if you need help to come off drugs, how can you be clean before you get help? Is there anyone else out there that will give you help before?
Yeah.
You know.
There's a lot of voluntary. Like, yeah, I have to really commend the 12-step fellowships, Alcoholics Anonymous, Cocaine Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, and a lot of churches, some of the Christian churches and Chinatlo. There are places where you can go when you're still in the thralls of addiction and begin to see some hope seeded into your heart. And I think that's the key piece, to realise and understand it can be done, that the insanity of addiction is that, simply an insanity of hopelessness and other things, you know.
But exactly.
Yeah, yeah. People around you.
Okay, Sean, I know we really have to go, but just before we go, I know you're doing, you're a minister now, and it's great. So how did you replace drugs? Like, what did you do to keep your mind occupied and, you know, to keep you going every day when the drugs were gone?
Yeah. Well, to be honest with you, I found a solution, and I don't really, I kind of deal flow with the idea that addiction is a spiritual malady, you know, and a lot of the 12-step fellowships would flow with that. So it's not so much a mind thing, although you're very right. We do need something to replace. For myself, it is, I have an active prayer life. I have a rich and enriched faith, and I also desire to see people come in the contact and path of the solution and that power, you know. So I really have to say that just a vigorous program of of self-development.
Great. Okay, Sean. Listen, thanks a million for talking. I could have talked to you for another half hour, but time is running out. But maybe in the future you might come into the studio and we'll have a chat, a more in-depth chat. And it's great to know that there's someone out there that can help people. You know, yourself, Colm, you do great work, and I'm sure plenty more people around are doing great work as well. But thanks a million for talking to us, and we'll talk again to you very soon. Keep up the good work.
Be blessed, Debbie. Roy, God bless today.
Thanks, Sean. Bye-bye.